I'd like to thank Andy. There are so many organizers, you have to pick one. He's my favorite organizer. I'd also like to ask you to save your questions for the question period, as Jim Hartle did, because the stuff I'm about to present is so unfamiliar to most of you that if we stop at any minute, every minute, to check that you understand the details, I'll never get any place. So let me start with the takeaway. The things I'm going to try to convince you of are that we don't really know a general recipe for deriving effective field theory from quantum gravity. There are two ideas about this, actually. One, a brilliant paper of Ted Jacobson from 1995, who showed us that Einstein's equations are sort of the thermodynamics, hydrodynamics for some system whose entropy is the area of local Wendler horizons. And he said in that paper, that means that these fields are not necessarily the fundamental quantum variables, and I believe he was right. We also have another origin of effective field theory in quantum gravity. I believe in string theory, in anti-de Sitter space and asymptotically flat space, which are the places where we really have rigorous models of string theory. And in those cases, we have particles, and those lead us to quantized fields, at least in some approximation. I'm going to try to argue to you that there's a general holographic theory of space-time, which is based on really a very simple fact. The holographic principle determines areas in terms of dimensions of Hilbert spaces, and we've known for a long time from quantum field theory that we can think about causal structure in terms of commutivity of operators. And we can put those two things together to get a completely quantum mechanical definition of what we would normally think of as a space-time if we use the holographic principle as a postulate. And if you do that, the Lorentzian geometry that you're talking about is not a fluctuating quantum variable. It has to do with the Hilbert spaces in the quantum mechanics. And I'll tell you what I think the real variables are. I'll tell you how to understand particles in terms of those variables. I'll tell you that when the covariant entropy bound is close to being saturated, the description in terms of particles is bad, and I'll give you a mechanical way of understanding how that could happen in a Hamiltonian. And then I'll argue that during most of cosmology, at least the very early universe cosmology that we're talking about at this conference, we were in such a situation where the covariant entropy bound was almost saturated, and therefore field theoretic methods are not good. So I'll give you several really well-defined quantum mechanical models illustrating some of these points, and then I'll give you a fantasy about how to put them together to make a real model that might look something like the universe we live in. It's a consequence of these ideas that we should not think of different solutions of Einstein's equations with different amounts of matter in them as different states of the same theory, which is the basis for much of the thinking about eternal inflation. We should instead think of them as different Hamiltonians, different quantum theories of space-time. Okay. Now, Willy already told you something about this. Let me remind you very quickly of the things that Willy said. He talked about a system we call the dense black hole fluid. It's a well-defined quantum mechanical model, which has a cartoon version, which Willy told you about, where you shouldn't pay too much attention to, where you can understand how a collection of black holes could have these properties. But what it really is a Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian, as I'll be emphasizing to you, is the Hamiltonian of associated with a single time-like world line in space-time, and it defines time evolution along that world line from the point of view of an observer, some machine that travels along that world line. It's a complete description of the entire universe, but there will be other observers who have partly redundant, and the degree of redundancy will depend on when you are. They have partly redundant information about space-time, and we will see how those things fit together to make a space-time. the fundamental variables satisfy a superalgebra, a bosonic and fermionic algebra. It has of order n times n plus 1 times d operators. D has something to do with the dimension of the spinner bundle over the compact dimensions. I'll just briefly talk about that. And what Willie showed you is that if this theory converges for large n, it starts out as a sort of random time-dependent Hamiltonian that changes to a different random Hamiltonian at each point in time on an ever-growing Hilbert space. That is to say, it all operates in a single Hilbert space, but it couples in more and more degrees of freedom as the time step goes on. Then this Hamiltonian at large n approaches something that has the coarse-grained properties, and here very much in the sense of Ted Jacobson, the coarse-grained description of a flat P equals rho FRW universe, and this happens for generic initial state. So flatness, homogeneity, and isotropy occur at late times independent of your initial state and with no inflation. This is a picture of how things work. Each of those blue lines is the trajectory of some time-like, it's some time-like trajectory. There's a sequence of causal diamonds defined by that trajectory. Each of the trajectories starts at a fixed time. There's nothing in quantum mechanics that forbids you from starting at a fixed time if you have time-dependent Hamiltonians. In this formalism, as the causal diamond grows, as time goes on, you have to couple in more and more degrees of freedom, so the Hamiltonian must be time dependent. And therefore, the assumption of a fixed initial time and the assumption of a time dependent Hamiltonian go together. And that's one of the conditions that allows this formalism to mock up things we associate with causality and locality. The second thing is that we don't just present you with the Hamiltonian for one observer's view of this cosmology, but for an infinite class of observers. Roughly speaking, spaced of order the Planck scale apart on some kind of a lattice. You should not pay any attention to the geometry of that lattice except that two things that are one unit apart on that lattice remain of order Planck scale apart in space forever. The overlaps between other points on the lattice satisfy different rules that are not the geometry of the lattice, though they're related to it. And what we do is we give a time-dependent Hamiltonian for each of those observers at each of those points and specify overlaps between their Hilbert spaces, common tensor factors between the two Hilbert spaces of any pairs of observers, with a consistency condition that on those common tensor factors, well, the state of the system will generally be a density matrix because it's a pure state in each observer's individual Hilbert space. It's a density matrix in some tensor factor of that Hilbert space. The two density matrices prescribed by each of the two observers should be unitarily equivalent to each other at each time. For each pair of points, that's an infinite number of consistency conditions. Our models all satisfy all of those consistency conditions. There's a particular overlap rule for this dense black hole fluid model where the overlap depends only on the number of steps that you take away, the minimum number of steps between the two points on the lattice, and in a way that's geometrically obvious, if this number of steps is large, that becomes spherically symmetric in the limit and really doesn't depend on the fact that I've chosen a cubic lattice rather than some other lattice. The lattice is really just keeping track of the topology of spacetime. Okay. Now I'm going to, excuse me, describe a variant of this model which describes a transition from an FRW which is flat, homogeneous, and isotropic, and has P equals rho, to an FRW, which is flat, homogeneous, and isotropic, and has P equals minus rho. It's really easy. In the previous model, we allowed this evolution to go on forever. Each observer had a Hilbert space that grew to arbitrarily large size. We now just stop at some point, and we change the overlap rules so that if you're more than n steps away on the lattice, there's no overlap whatsoever. So each guy overlaps with each of his nearest neighbors out to n steps, but afterwards not. That rule also satisfies the consistency conditions if we stop all the Hilbert spaces from growing. Okay? Different model. Satisfies the consistency conditions. Has a finite dimensional Hilbert space for each observer. And the Hamiltonian on that Hilbert space is random. That Hamiltonian, if you follow the rules of the previous model, has a typical eigenvalue, which is of order n. But since it's a Hamiltonian of a conformal field theory, it's actually possible to just do a change of variables to take it to a Hamiltonian whose typical eigenvalue is order 1 over n. You just reduce the cutoff in momentum space and increase the lattice size, and that changes the typical eigenvalue. A Hamiltonian, which is random, has a typical eigenvalue 1 over n. Remember, n was cosmological time. That means it's also the distance to the horizon. The Hilbert space grows to have dimension e to the pi times n squared. And such a Hamiltonian was proposed some years ago by myself, Fiol, and Maurice as a proper description of an eternal de Sitter space, that thing that Lenny doesn't believe in. Okay? So there's a model of it here. This model exists. Whether eternal de Sitter space exists or not, we don't know, but this model certainly exists. And what we showed is... No. From the point... Good. Thank you. From the point that the Hilbert space stops growing, we stop with a fixed Hamiltonian. Okay. Now, in this paper that I don't have time to go into the details of, we showed that if you have such a Hamiltonian and another Hamiltonian that I'll call P, the Poincaré Hamiltonian, which has a commutator with H such that for small eigenvalues of P, that commutator is small, and this number little n is large, and the bound on the eigenvalues of P are n, is n, and the entropy deficit of the P eigenspace with energy E is 2 pi n times E, then this reproduces the qualitative dynamics of de Sitter space. And I'll show you even more dynamics of de Sitter space when I describe the variables. We'll see where particles in de Sitter space come from in this description. So I can't tell you about the details of that. You'll have to believe me that I get something that at least crudely describes de Sitter space. To understand it a little more, let me introduce finally the variables that I talked about. As Willie explained to you, the variables in this theory should be thought of as sections of the spinner bundle over the holographic screen. The holographic screen is a compact Euclidean manifold. If we think of it as a real geometry, then that has an infinite number of sections of the spinner bundle, but the holographic principle tells you that can't be right. There have to be only a finite number of variables. And it just means a spinner-valued function on the manifold that, you know, has transition rules that, you know, spinners are not well-defined, and you have to tell me the transition rules between. That's all it means. If there were a mathematician in the audience and I said a section means a function, he'd shoot me. I'd rather you shoot me. Okay. Now, a beautiful way to cut off the spinner bundle of a general compact manifold is to observe that the Dirac operator on such a manifold has a discrete spectrum that goes up to infinity. if I put a large eigenvalue cutoff at some fixed eigenvalue on it, then that gives me a finite number of sections of the spinner bundle. And that's what these variables are. The spinner bundle over the two-sphere, well, I'm going to be thinking always of space-time compactified to Minkowski space, which has a two-sphere holographic screen, times some compact dimensions. The spinner bundle over the two-sphere with this cutoff is very easy to understand. It's the set of all n by n plus 1 matrices, which contains all angular momenta up to n minus 1 and n minus a half. And there's a conjugate spinner bundle. You know there are two chiralities of spinner on the two-sphere. And that's what Psi and Psi Dagger are. P and Q label the internal spinner bundle. And I won't talk about that anymore in this talk, except to note that with this definition of compact geometry, there is no such thing as a continuous modulus. Moduli fields, as we know them in string theory, don't appear in this formalism, except in limits where you take that cutoff to infinity. They appear as continuous ratios of integers in such limits. Now, furthermore, this cutoff preserves symmetries on your manifolds, if they happen to be there, and they preserve the property of the internal manifold having a covariantly constant spinner. If that's the case, you can show that on the right-hand side, sorry, I'm pointing in the wrong place, on the right-hand side of this equation, okay, there's a piece that's proportional to the unit matrix. In general, what's on the right-hand side, for string theorists, these are wrapped brain charges, and the whole thing satisfies some non-abelian superalgebra in general, but there's a piece proportional to the unit operator in the internal space here, and given that, you can show that in the limit where n, the number of I and A indices, goes to infinity, you reproduce supersymmetry. It follows from these commutation relations plus the assumption that as we go out to an infinite-sized two-sphere, we get conformal invariance on the two-sphere, which is just Lorentz invariance in space. In that case, there are conformal killing spinners on the two-sphere, and if you take these variables and smear them with the conformal killing spinners, you get generators that satisfy the supersymmetry algebra. They're the supersymmetry algebra for a single massless particle. I'll tell you where multiparticle states come from in just a minute. I guess I'm about to do that. No, the one thing I want to emphasize before I go to do that is this is the only place momentum comes from in this formalism. So you don't get the Poincaré group without getting the super Poincaré group. This formalism kinematically follows the principle that the only time you get asymptotically flat space is by having supersymmetry as well. Okay, now, this is when n, the total number of dimensions on the total number of spinner sections on the two-sphere goes to infinity. Which is the same as lambda goes to zero, which is the same as the radius going to infinity in Planck units. Okay, now how do we understand particles? This is something that was Lenny's idea in a paper called Matrix Theory, long, long time ago. We understood how matrices could give rise to particles. Actually, that had appeared in lots of particle physics literature before that. The basic idea is that if I take a matrix variable and there's some good approximation where I can isolate block diagonal matrices, then the statistics of block diagonal matrices, the parametrization of block diagonal matrices has an SN gauge symmetry, which plays the role of particle statistics. And with these kinds of anti-commutation relations, you get the right connection between spin and statistics, the right set of minus signs. And so among all of these matrices, you can think of particle variables as coming from block diagonal matrices in some approximation where you can decouple them from all of the rest. Now, what about momentum variables? Well, I'll refer to matrix theory for the understanding, which I could try to explain to you here, that the momentum in the direction, oh, by the way, I didn't say it, but the momenta that come out of here are all on-shell momenta of massless particles. So you automatically get a set of supersymmetric massless particles, and with the number of spinners corresponding to 11 compact dimensions, you have enough spin to get a spin 2 particle in that spectrum. Momentum is the size of the block, the momentum in the direction that you're moving. The angular localization of that momentum is obviously encoded in the spinner wave function. So in this formalism, and this is different than matrix theory, the localization on the sphere at infinity is tied to how much momentum you have. If you have less momentum, you have less localization. The natural unit of momentum is 1 over the radius in Planck units. Well, it's 1 over the radius, which is 1 over n in Planck units. And now you have a problem, because suppose I want to take a limit of this system which will have more or less the content of field theory. Well, I said I could do that if I could decouple the block diagonal matrices from the others, but also I'd like to have a lot of blocks, and I'd also like to have each block be very big, because I want a lot of spherical harmonics in order to localize it on the sphere. So there's a problem. You can't do it arbitrarily well. And when you do it, you try to get a lot of particles with a lot of localization. The best compromise is to take the blocks to be of order square root of n in size. You can put in much larger blocks, but fewer of them. Okay? This is, again, similar to matrix theory with finite n. Here, the finite n is a property of De Sitter space. It's the radius. Or a property of a fixed causal diamond in Minkowski space. At this moment, the formalism doesn't distinguish between the two. That really comes in the Hamiltonian. So let's do the counting. I have square root of n by square root of n blocks, and there are square root of n of them. So I have n to the 3/2 copies of this algebra. Each representation of the algebra has some dimension, so that gives me an entropy of order n to the 3/2. If any of you have ever done the exercise, can I make up black hole entropy by thinking about massless particles, the most entropic thing among ordinary matter, you find precisely that same scaling for the maximum entropy in massless particles. And the momentum cutoff that comes here for the most entropic state, again, mirrors exactly what you get from the field theory argument. So I submit that it's very plausible that these variables describe particles, and they tell us how particle physics is forcibly distorted in a De Sitter universe. If I insist that this is a De Sitter universe, and I can't make this n bigger just by going to a bigger causal diamond in Minkowski space. So far, I haven't distinguished between those two. Now, the supersymmetry Hamiltonian, which I showed you, just comes out of the anti-commutation relations of the psis, is bilinear in the psis. So it automatically decouples the blocks, the things on the main diagonal block, from the rest of the variables. That is the Hamiltonian, which approximately I'm going to think of as the Hamiltonian of an observer in this causal diamond following a geodesic trajectory. I can now think about the same causal diamond and say, let's talk about accelerated observers in the same system. Well, from our point of view, what that means is go to a different Hamiltonian. A Hamiltonian is tied to a particular time-like world line. And so the way you do it is you take this bilinear Hamiltonian that describes the particles seen by the geodesic observer and put in some quartic couplings in it of the matrices with traces with a coefficient that depends on the acceleration. Now, Lenny has conjectured that Hamiltonians like that generically form what are called fast scramblers. That is to say, they very rapidly mix up the information in the Hilbert space and give you a generic state of the Hilbert space. And the amount of that mixing is going to be proportional to the quartic and higher order terms that we stick in. And so our claim is that this is the way we understand the Unruh effect as corresponding to these different Hamiltonians, and there's some maximally accelerated observer that skims past the horizon with almost touching the horizon of this causal diamond, and that's the observer that Ted Jacobson was talking about that sees the entire entropy of the system. Sorry. Yes, that says n squared. I'm sorry. I didn't realize how obscure the dark font would be. I'll do better next time when you invite me back. Okay. So now I've told you something that is roughly the same in Minkowski space in a large causal diamond or in De Sitter space with a large radius. Okay. In De Sitter space with a large radius, there's actually some more interesting stuff we can say about this system. So in Minkowski space with a large radius, if I have a causal diamond and I excite n squared of the degrees of freedom, we know what happens. I get a black hole. It doesn't have a particle physics interpretation. The states of it are not well described by particle physics. They are described by some fast scrambler Hamiltonian. Okay? But in De Sitter space, if I'm in one horizon volume and I don't accelerate, then I expect that I might be able to, if I don't do terrible things and create large black holes, that there might be other horizon volumes that I'm not in contact with. And in this formalism, those arise as off-diagonal bands. So it's the usual story of clock and shift operators. The ones are the main diagonal. The twos plus one guy down here are the main off-diagonal. The threes plus two guys down here are the next off-diagonal. They're all identical to each other. They're transformations in this index space that take one into the other. If I write down this Poincaré Hamiltonian, the bilinear, it splits up these different things. It splits up into a sum of Hamiltonians describing the different horizon volumes and describes particle physics in of order square root of n horizon volumes. The classical theory of De Sitter space says there are an infinite number of horizon volumes if you wait long enough. That leads to all kinds of infinities if you take it seriously. What this theory is saying is, no, cut that off. But the cutoff is square root of n, the square root of the radius in Planck units, which could be a very large number. So you can see how approximately quantum field theory in De Sitter space can come out of this formalism as well. Now, in the basic idea of the De Sitter model is you keep n finite. And even the geodesic observer's Hamiltonian has a small multilinear piece, which gives rise to thermalization at the De Sitter temperature. The thing you want to show, and we haven't yet shown for this particular model, and this might have something to do of how random the random Hamiltonian is that this Poincaré Hamiltonian has precisely the relationship between energy and entropy deficit that we postulated for the theory of De Sitter space. It's clear in this Hamiltonian that as I increase the Poincaré energy, the entropy deficit gets bigger. Because if I talk about particle states with some fixed angular momentum state, then I've frozen a larger and larger, if the momentum is larger, I've frozen a larger and larger number of these variables. And so the entropy of the state has gone down. Whether that works precisely or not, we don't know. There's also a way to incorporate De Sitter black holes with the usual black hole entropy and energy formulas into this. But the theory is not complete by any means. On the other hand, it's definitely well-defined, and it definitely has lots of the characteristics of the theory of De Sitter space as we know it from quantum field theory. So I have a lot of confidence that it's going to work out. Now I want to talk about effective field theory. So I've taken this short excursion into de Sitter space because my cosmology now started off with P equals rho and went to de Sitter space. And I want to talk about effective field theory for that cosmology. Now, the way we do effective field theory in string theory is we've got string theory. It's not effective field theory. And we compute the scattering matrix, or the ADS correlators, and then we make up an effective field theory that matches those answers in some approximation. So what Ted Jacobson taught us is that we should be able to do that at some coarse-grained level for every space-time. If we have a quantum theory that corresponds to a space-time, there should be some effective field equations that describe it. Ted's derivation had an energy momentum tensor on the right-hand side. That came in because he was using the laws of thermodynamics, and those have an energy in them, and he thought of that as the integral of the energy momentum tensor across some surface, but he didn't specify what it is. If I try to write down a consistent effective field theory with an energy momentum tensor, then I'm going to have to write down some degrees of freedom that give rise to that energy and momentum. And there is a field theory that reproduces the dynamics of this universe. It's very simple. You all know it. I take a scalar field, a single scalar field. I couple it to gravity. I couple it to gravity with a potential which is just a constant. And I start out with a kinetic energy much bigger than the potential. Then, as you all know, that system behaves like a P equals rho fluid in the beginning and evolves to de Sitter space. Okay? The important point I want to make is that in this system, it would be a terrible mistake to start to try to quantize the modes of that field. The inhomogeneous modes of that field do not represent any excitations of this system, even though its coarse-grained dynamics describes this system. This system is defined by the quantum mechanics that I've given you. It's completely well-defined. It has a finite number of states. I can compute everything in terms of those initial variables. And the fluctuations in these conditions don't look like particles because I've chosen my cosmological Hamiltonian not to be the Poincaré Hamiltonian, but I've chosen my cosmological Hamiltonian to start out as the Hamiltonian that described the P equals rho fluid and then just stop and rescale to get the energy scale right for the de Sitter Hamiltonian. The energy scale 1 over n for the de Sitter Hamiltonian, by the way, is the thing that says that the de Sitter Hamiltonian does things on a shortest time scale, which is of order the de Sitter Hubble length. And that's sort of the thing we want. You're used to thinking about a localized Hamiltonian for fields in de Sitter space, which has much larger eigenvalues. But that's the Hamiltonian of the Poincaré observer. The cosmology does not have that Hamiltonian. So now I'm going to only tell you about another model and another solution of Einstein's equations that goes with it. This is a model in which we do what we just did, but only inside some tilted cube on the lattice. The lattice, a finite distance, according to our overlap rules, is a tilted cube of a finite number of steps away from a given point. That's a sphere in the real geometry. And inside that sphere, we use these rules. And then outside the sphere, we use the rules of the P equals rho fluid, which goes on forever. And there's a consistent set of overlap rules, which stops the evolution rules of the two separate infinite FRWs at the boundary of that sphere. And it satisfies our criteria, and it's a perfectly well-defined quantum mechanical system that looks very far away from that sphere, like the P equals rho fluid. And inside that sphere, it looks like de Sitter space to an internal observer. There is, in fact, a solution of Einstein's equations with a scalar field and spherical symmetry that starts out with homogeneous P equals rho, but it has some excitation of the scalar field inside a radius, which evolves to a black hole embedded in the FRW spacetime with an interior which is non-singular, because there's a non-zero cosmological constant, a positive one that's possible, and it's non-singular, and it evolves to de Sitter space inside. And there are some solutions by Mazur and Motola that are some approximation to that, and I don't have time to go into the details of either this model or the solutions, because now I want to talk about models of our universe. And up until now, I've been talking about real models, okay? That is to say, you know, I have a Hamiltonian, I have rules, I can put it on a computer. The new models, which are supposed to be the ones that come closer to describing the real world, are not going to be quite so well defined, but they'll all live in finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and so they'll be pretty well defined. It's only a question of whether I can do certain things that I claim to do. So first of all, I want to make a point, which I'll talk about later, which is that from the Einstein equation point of view, it's clear that there are solutions of Einstein's equations that correspond to multiple black holes with de Sitter interiors. And we believe that with enough work, we could try to construct models that correspond to those solutions, too. We don't know how to do that. And one reason that it should be hard is if you think about black holes in a P equals rho universe, then they attract each other, they're pushed apart by the Hubble expansion, they have a complicated dynamics. What's clear is that there are initial conditions for which some black holes will remain away from each other forever. Some black holes may merge. You can put in lots of black holes of lots of different sizes, and people who love the anthropic principle, and since I was one of the first people to make that argument, I like the anthropic argument for the cosmological constant pretty much. I think this is ripe for anthropic selection, but in order to make it work, you have to show that you can make a model of a real universe in this system. I'll use the multiple black holes only at the end if somebody bugs me about Boltzmann's brains. I hope you won't. Okay. Now I want to talk about entropy. So let's say I say every universe starts at the Big Bang in this P equals rho state. This is a completely non-singular description of the Big Bang. Everybody except perhaps Paul and Neil and their group would agree that that's the kind of matter that, if it exists, would dominate what's going on near the singularity, because it scales like 1 over 8 to the 6th. And so that's a reasonable assumption for the beginning. And now let me condition on the fact that I evolve in the future inside some region to some value of the positive cosmological constant. What's a universe that does that in a way that I start out at the maximal entropy initial state consistent with those conditions? And the answer is, I've written it down for you. It's the black hole embedded in the P equals rho fluid. That system saturates the covariant entropy bound at every single moment and for every single observer. You wouldn't want to live there. You wouldn't even want to visit. Okay. So I'd like to make, since you're all my friends, I'd like to make a universe that you might want to visit me in. Okay. Well, I think you guys claim that there's something that dominates over 1 over 8 to the 6th near the singularity. Oh, I take it back. I didn't understand your talks. Okay. So okay. I apologize. It was my misunderstanding. Okay. Plus plus the fact that De Sitter space in the with the Hamiltonian that we gave saturates the covariant entropy bound as well. And we're in the De Sitter vacuum, according to this. And so we're always saturating the covariant entropy bound. So in such a universe, well, those of you who really, really like Boltzmann's brains might want to visit there because that's the only kind of organized activity or life that you can have in such a universe, a spontaneous fluctuation. I don't have any friends who are Boltzmann brains, I don't think. And I'm going to try to do a little bit better than that. So I showed you that I could make this FRW that evolved locally to some value of the cosmological constant in a consistent way. I'm going to make something that I'm going to want to eventually evolve to the De Sitter horizon volume embedded in P equals rho, but start out for some period. Remember, I've got a time-dependent Hamiltonian, a big advantage over all the rest of you guys. Okay? It's going to start out for some period with the rules of my FRW model, which ends up in a De Sitter space, but with a much larger cosmological constant than the eventual one. So what happens when I do that? You sort of have this tilted cube on the lattice of observers, and you've broken it up into little tilted cubes. And let me remind you that if I look at the centers, if these cubes have side n, and the whole thing has side capital N, which is much bigger than n, then in these cubes, if I look at the centers of these different cubes, there's no overlap between any of the centers. So one of the issues with this formalism is redundant degrees of freedom because the lattice contains duplication of everything. In this model, the degrees of freedom counted by the centers of those cubes are independent of all the other degrees of freedom in the big cube. Now, there are correlations between them, but they're independent degrees of freedom because they live in just completely separate Hilbert spaces. So in this model, if I just try to write this configuration down, it's inconsistent. Because the Hilbert space on the boundary has to have dimension capital N in order to be consistent with the boundary conditions I put in from the P equals rho fluid on the outside. But these Hilbert spaces only have dimension little n. So up to time little n, everything is consistent. But then the overlap rules start to fall apart. What I'm going to hypothesize is that there's some way to now take these independent degrees of freedom and couple them together. In our formalism, what that means is that every point on this lattice, after having evolved some time with its little Hamiltonian in a small Hilbert space, now starts to evolve in a bigger and bigger Hilbert space. And I'm hoping that my partner over there will figure out how to make that happen in a way that mimics local interactions between these different volumes. Now, if we do that, what I claim we'll have is a universe that starts in P equals rho, goes through a period of inflation, and then eventually evolves to a constant cosmological constant. It can't do anything else because that's the boundary condition I put on the outside. It has to eventually evolve to a system that's consistent with having Hamiltonians on the end that mix up an entire e to the n squared dimensional Hilbert space. So if that's correct, and this is inflation, then these are inflationary horizon volumes, and I can read off the number of e-foldings in this geometry. Notice I don't put the geometry in by hand. I'm reading off the number of e-foldings by counting how many degrees of freedom I have. I want to have some number of copies of these horizon volumes, which have little n squared degrees of freedom. And I want to put those together in such a way that I've got in total n squared degrees of freedom so that when I allow this guy's Hilbert space to grow, I can think of that information as having come in from his local neighbors. Well, let me get to homogeneity. Yes, first of all, this is absolutely homogeneous inside. The rules so far are completely homogeneous. And notice that's true independently of what the initial state was. That's just a function of the dynamics and the consistency conditions. Now, when I do this, I'm eventually going to get capital N squared degrees of freedom, so I can count how many of these little things I can allow, okay, by just counting degrees of freedom. I've got entropy N squared total, and I have to break it up into some number of blocks. And that gives me a number of E-folds, and it's fixed by the ratio of the inflationary and current cosmological constants. And it comes out, roughly speaking, to be 88, or some number like that. Sorry, 10-minute warning. Okay. Now, the next thing that I'd like to point out is that if I take this model and I look at the coarse grain density matrix inside each of these degrees of freedom before I start to allow them to couple together, it's the unit matrix because I'm using the random Hamiltonian of de Sitter space in each of these things. And if I take a system that's a tensor product of a bunch of other systems and the density matrix, which is the unit matrix in each of the smaller systems, that's the unit density matrix in the big system. And so in a coarse-grained way, this system looks like the de Sitter vacuum. But in fact, if I look microscopically at the quantum state, there's no reason for the quantum state in each of these guys to be exactly the same. They could be related to each other by arbitrary unitary transformations, and that sweeps out the whole space. So there are fluctuations of the quantum state when I go from point to point. And if I look at some operator in the theory that's sensitive to what the quantum state is and not just what the density matrix is, it'll have fluctuations. Now, I've told you there is, for any de Sitter space, a Poincaré Hamiltonian that I can define. That's going to be the Hamiltonian that I'm going to identify with us. That Hamiltonian, think of associating one of those with each of the central points in each of these little blocks. That Hamiltonian has fluctuations that I know something about, namely they're thermal at the de Sitter temperature. So I know they go like 1 over little n. That's the usual inflationary prediction, roughly, for the size of the fluctuation. And these fluctuations, I believe, are Gaussian just because, at least initially, because they have it's a copy of the distribution for a large number of things, so the central limit theorem applies. Now, our hope is that when we understand how to couple these things together, we will get just the theory of a scalar field in de Sitter space, and the fluctuations will be scale invariant as well. That's a pious hope at the moment. But it looks pretty good because everything is the same from here to here. It looks like de Sitter in each of these volumes. If it looks like locality at all, I fail to see how it could look like anything but quantum field theory in de Sitter space. So I'm obviously speculating like mad at this point, maybe not on the scale that it's done at this conference, but for me, this is speculating like mad. Okay. Now, the other thing I'd like to emphasize is that in all the models that I've talked about so far, except when I was talking about the S matrix, and even then, there was no hint of where locality comes from in the real world. And my vision is that this is the origin of locality. In other words, added to the great virtues of inflation that Alan has talked about for lo these 30 years, we have the fact that locality in the real world comes from the fact that there was a period of inflation. We wouldn't have had any locality if it had not been for inflation, according to this model. Okay. All right, the rest of this is just words saying we hope it works. And let me quickly end with anthropic constraints. And these are really rather different in this class of models than what most people are used to, because in these models, when our cosmological constant goes to zero, we reach a theory where supersymmetry is restored. And that theory doesn't look anything like the real world. It can't have people in it. There are anthropic constraints on lambda that come from microphysics. We believe that there are also anthropic constraints on dark matter in this model, and that has more to do with details of phenomenological models I've tried to guess at, motivated by this framework, than anything I could derive rigorously. But assuming that's the case, then as lambda goes, that lambda and the dark matter density are very likely in this model applied to the real world to be things that are determined anthropically or otherwise, maybe just by the mathematics of the model. Lambda, of course, not, but the dark matter density might be determined by the mathematics to be what it is in the real world. Now, we have a whole set of models of the universe. They're not, as they are for most of you, different states of the same theory of the universe, but they're different models with different sets of black holes inside of which we have different universes that evolve to de Sitter spaces with different cosmological constants. So in particular, the size of the initial fluctuations can fluctuate between those guys, and I can have an anthropic scanning of it. And if I just count entropy and say, what's the most entropic way to do this? Well, it's obviously to have no fluctuation at all. I told you, the most entropic universe of this type, just conditioning on the initial and final states, is just go directly from the initial to the final state with no inflationary intermediate and no local physics. So Q is non-zero because of local physics. Entropy, this has to do with the fact that in de Sitter space, localized entropy actually costs you entropy. Making a big black hole in de Sitter space is lowering the entropy of the system. And so what we find is a bound that turns Weinberg on his head. Imagine that lambda and the dark matter density are fixed by microphysics, then the galaxy formation down says that Q is greater than roughly their ratio of those two to the 1/3 power by Weinberg's formula. Weinberg's formula had a discrepancy of a factor of 100 in it. This becomes a discrepancy of 4.6 in the formula for Q. And the statistical constraints wanting Q to be small are not necessarily so terrible. So I don't think that's that improbable. We could argue about that as one can over any anthropic prediction. Okay, I told you about fluctuations. Let me go to very quickly to conclusions. We have real quantum models. They're really real quantum models. We believe that in a coarse-grained way, they really describe things that satisfy Einstein's equation. Effective field theory doesn't work for anything except the coarse-grained description. We have an incomplete model with those same properties until the very end when it, after inflation, starts to use a Hamiltonian that approximately obeys the rules of local physics. And that model maybe predicts the right kind of fluctuations with relationships that Willie and I have proposed before, and Andy talked about something similar, and I think various other people have discussed this, relationships between the number of E-folds and various entropies of the universe at different times. The inflaton field is not a field that comes from the particle physics of the model. The inflaton field comes from this emergent time where field theory only describes very hydrodynamic aspects of the problem. It's a classical field, basically. Remember, it's got thermal fluctuations, and remember that the quantum fluctuations in the Bunch-Davies vacuum are thermal fluctuations. The inflaton field is emergent. I shouldn't be looking for it among the fields in my string theory of the eventual almost Poincaré invariant theory that I get at the end. Maybe we've understood somewhat how local space comes out of inflation, a new relation between inflation and properties of the real world. And the anthropic arguments, such as they are, seem to go in the opposite direction of the old ones. Thank you. There's a set of references, by the way.
First question, maybe I misunderstood, but you seem to be changing the Hamiltonian.
Absolutely.
And on what basis was that done?
On the basis that if you give me a beginning of the universe,
right,
and you give me this principle that the Hamiltonian has to couple together more and more degrees of freedom so that this mm-hmm. system, it's not a local field theory, but it mm-hmm. has to have the concept of a particle horizon in it, that there are some things I don't interact with until some late time, that forces the Hamiltonian to be time dependent.
So, but what is the rule through which you change it?
Okay, so we have a set of rules. The set of rules for the simple models that we actually know how to construct is that each step we choose a new random Hamiltonian, given the set of variables that we have, with the result that when the number of steps is very large, it approaches a 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory with a C, which is of order n squared. You can, by the way, understand the n squared because we have of order n squared variables, these psi fields. In these psi, they're not fields, these psi variables are there.
I'm really just asking, is this an arbitrary theory or is it a well-defined theory? Do you write down a certain set of assumptions and everything follows?
I can
or
write
do you
down,
change the okay. theory as you go along?
No, good. I think, okay. Cosmology, almost every cosmology, almost every solution of general relativity has no time like killing vectors, okay? If you solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation properly, what you realize what that means is that the Hamiltonian for quantum gravity, treated in the standard semi-classical way, is almost always time dependent. Almost always.
I thought it was zero. It's zero. Hamiltonian is zero.
No, that's an incorrect interpretation of that equation.
That is that equation.
No.
The equation is
that
the
equation,
H psi is zero.
That H is not the Hamiltonian of the quantum system. And the Wheeler-DeWitt wave function is not a wave function. It's just like the Klein-Gordon equation.
Okay.
You have d squared minus del squared equals zero. And t is time, not the generator of d by d x naught is the time, or some Lorentz transform of it, but not d squared minus del squared. Okay. So we call it the Hamiltonian constraint, but it's not the Hamiltonian.
So your Hamiltonian, which is not the Hamiltonian in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, is there a predefined rule as to what it is? Or you seem to be
okay.
changing it as the universe evolves.
What
to,
I just told you is that the Hamiltonian
just,
of
yeah.
the universe in almost every solution. Okay, you have,
so,
to,
so maybe
you
just,
have to back off, Neil,
yeah.
and accept my point of view just for a minute. Okay?
No,
according
wait,
to
I,
my point of view, hold on just a
yeah,
second.
Yeah.
According to my point of view, different space-time backgrounds correspond to different Hamiltonians.
Right.
Most of them time-dependent. Okay, mm-hmm. Our formalism makes that very clear. We have a Hamiltonian, which is time-dependent. We have a very set of severe constraints on what that Hamiltonian can be from all of these overlap rules, and we only accept models that obey those constraints. Once we've found a model that obeys those constraints, we say, hey, let's go see if we can follow Ted Jacobson and find a coarse-grain space-time that has the properties of our well-defined quantum model. And so far, we've succeeded. Okay? So that's the right way around to look at it.
But you seem to have pre-decided, I want something that looks like a space-time, which has a period of kinetic domination or p equals rho, then inflation, then a universe like, then lambda.
Okay.
You've kind of pre-decided that. What we would like is a theory which predicted
okay.
that.
So what I will No, I think that's actually incorrect. I think that if you take my point of view, different backgrounds correspond to different theories.
And there is no theory which tells
there's
you
no
the relative...
There's no theory which tells you which theory to choose.
Wow.
There's no meta-theory.
That's very scary.
Now, the other thing that I'd just like to say about this before... Yeah. One other thing I'd like to say about that, I challenge anybody. I'd be very happy if someone could show me a system obeying our rules that was a matter-dominated universe back to the Big Bang. Go ahead and do it. We couldn't do it. Perhaps. Oh, maybe I do have friends. Yeah, okay. So the answer is I think so, but I don't know. And I really don't really think things until I have a model that corresponds to them. So we don't have a model that corresponds to that situation. We wrote a paper about that situation in which we conjectured precisely what you just said. But I don't know. First of all, what I showed you explicitly in this talk is that there are absolutely homogeneous isotropic universes. They're only isotropic at late times that are maximal entropy at every time. Maximal entropy at every time. So the fact that the entropy grows, that's great. That'll give me a homogeneous isotropic universe. I would say that if I think about a state of particles, that indeed in a collapsing universe perturbations grow, and that what I produce by doing that, supposing it was originally homogeneous and isotropic, the perturbations will grow, merge into black holes, and the black holes will eventually fill the universe with a homogeneous B equals rho fluid. Okay? But I don't really say that to you because I won't say that until I've got a model that does that. Yes.
So right now I'm apparently in the same space, but how do you check the consider space? Meaning to say, how do you check enough symmetry to transform from one static patch to another?
Okay.
How do you get around the no-load here?
Okay. So what the set of variables of this system manifestly has and the Hamiltonian of the geodesic observer in the static patch has a collection of square root of n things, which are all identical to each other, and the variables have a permutation symmetry that mixes up those horizon volumes and makes each one. Now, if I construct a Hamiltonian which is consistent with that symmetry, I will have a system that looks in each horizon volume like field theory in De Sitter space better and better as n goes to infinity. There will be square root of n horizon volumes with an explicit symmetry that interchanges them. It'll be discrete. It will not be the De Sitter group, but it can very easily converge to the De Sitter group. Yeah, we also know that there are Q-deformed versions of the De Sitter algebra that have finite-dimensional unitary representations. So, again, we haven't constructed that in this model.
Okay, we have one last question.
Hi, Doug.
I can shout. I won't shout. I turn it on. So, in this picture, you have you say that in these square boxes, you can think of this now as in some sense the sitter space. So how then do you transition into a reheating, you know, reheat the universe into the standard cosmology?
Okay. That's an extremely good question, and I really wish I knew how to answer it, but I don't yet know how to answer it. And, you know, we believe the first thing that we might be able to do in the near term is try to show that the dynamics that I outlined to you here is really reproducing the dynamics of the scalar field in De Sitter space. And then at the phenomenological level, the theory also has in it variables that describe particles, and if I've chosen my compact dimensions correctly, it'll be particles that look like the ones in the real world, and there's some coupling between those things that I could try to describe by effective field theory. I consider that an inadequate answer. I'd really like to have a more microscopic description of reheating, but we're way far away from that.
That's a good question.